Since I was always rather a rebellious student, I decided that instead of playing all those scales, I would make my own scales. And I would make my own conceptions of the vertical, which is harmonic, the horizontal, which is the linear. And in doing that, began the pleasure principle. Because if you make your scales based on that which pleases your senses, so that it is not a question from that point of discipline, it becomes perhaps an expression of the joy of living. Because one of the things that the cab driver and I got into was the fact that, for me, music has saved my life. Because you also, it is something that no matter what kind of unfortunate social situation that you might be in, or whatever kind of rage or frustration, thing that has always brought me back to understanding that there is another purpose of living is music. And once you get into that, and all of a sudden you see it, it is, you send out perhaps the vibrations of the joy, but it also makes your insides feel in a certain way.
That was a section of Diatom Ribbons, the title track from pianist Chris Davis's new album, which comes out next week. It features a whole bunch of people. The personnel changes track to track, but the full lineup includes Terry Lynn Carrington on drums, Val Jonty on electronics, Esperanza Spalding on vocals on two tracks, Trevor Dunn on bass, Nels Klein and Mark Ribot on guitars, Tony Malaby and J.D. Allen on tenor saxes, and Ches Smith on vibraphone. Chris Davis is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content on burningambulance.com and improve the podcast, so become a subscriber if you can. Chris Davis is originally from Canada, but she's been on the New York music scene for almost 20 years. She's made a number of excellent albums as a leader and as a solo artist, and is also a member of groups like Paradoxical Frog with Ingrid Laubrock and Tyshawn Sorey, and Anti-House with Laubrock, Mary Halverson, who it was announced this week has won a MacArthur Fellowship, so congratulations to her, John Hebert, and Tom Rainey. I saw that group, Anti-House, perform at the Vision Festival at Roulette in Brooklyn back in 2012, and they've got three albums out which are all worth your time. She also recently joined a group formed by cornet player Rob Masaryk with Engebrecht Hoker Flatten and Chad Taylor for his Desert and Crypts Festival out in Marfa, Texas, and they've released a live recording, Desert and Crypts Volume 1, which you'll hear a little excerpt from in a minute before the interview starts. In this conversation, we talk about Ms. Davis's music, her label Pyroclastic, which is where Diatom Ribbons is coming out, and also where Chris Lightcap, who was on the last podcast, is releasing his Super Big Mouth album. Both of those records are coming out next week, October 4th. We also talk about composing and arranging and her work at Berklee College of Music, where she's just joined the faculty. As I said, I'm going to play another piece of music now, which is Encrypt 2 Spiral from the Desert Encrypts album. And right after that, you'll hear my interview with Chris Davis. Davis.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Good, good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah. So,
where are you calling from?
I'm in Jersey. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, where are you?
I am in Ossining.
Oh, wow. You're way upstate. Okay. I just sort of assumed you lived in Brooklyn or something.
No. Not so far upstate, but yeah. It's not in New York City.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Did we meet before?
I don't think we've ever met face-to-face, no. I know I've seen you play at the Vision Festival and stuff, so.
Okay.
A few years ago. Okay. I guess with Anti-House.
Oh, yeah, that must have been a while ago.
Yeah. It was you on the bill and then Burnt Sugar afterward, I think.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. That was probably 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while. Cool.
So, I guess I'll just sort of dive right in.
Sure.
Your first album as a leader was about 15 years ago now. So, what do you remember about your intentions and goals going into that session? Was there like an overriding concept behind the record, or was it just like, I've written this many tunes, let's go?
You mean Lifespan, the very first one?
Yeah.
That was like 2003. Let me think back. I mean, I think at that time I had just moved to New York and I was still trying to meet people. And I was also taking lessons with Jim McNeely, and it was my first, I just started composing when I moved to New York at that time. So I was still trying to figure out what kind of a composer I wanted to be and trying all sorts of different things. I guess that record, you know, all my records I consider just a documentation of a certain time period, what I was interested in, what was going on in my life at that time. And that first record was really me discovering composition and connecting with people in the scene, in the New York scene, that eventually became close collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you had more or less the same band, Tony Malaby, Ivan Dobzhvik, and then your then-husband on the second and third albums also, The Slightest Shift and Rye Eclipse. So was that like a steadily working band to any degree? Like, did you guys tour much, you know, stuff like that?
Yeah, it was. The quartet especially spent a lot of time playing together, even just in Tony's living room, and then making beans and rice and hanging out after. I wrote a lot of the music for that quartet, the second record and third records, the ones you mentioned, The Slightest Shift and Rye Eclipse, focusing more on that quartet and the idea of improvisation and composition, blending and blurring those lines. So the group played quite a bit, in sessions at Tony's house, but also then I think I did my first Canadian tour with that quartet, and I put together some little local tours and things just to get us playing. Rye Eclipse was recorded right after that Canadian tour, so that was everyone was like, you gotta go on the road and work out the music and then go home and record right after. So that was my first experience doing that.
Is there a moment when you're leading a band and it's been together for an album or two and you've played together on the road and stuff like that and you're writing music, is there a moment where it kind of clicks into place for you that you say, okay, now I'm writing for this particular group's voice and I know that these are the choices that I can make and these are the choices that I'm not going to make because of who I'm writing for?
Well, some of the groups that I have come out of playing together first, maybe in some other configuration or, playing, improvising, and just finding a connection there. So in that circumstance, I usually have an idea of what the person sounds like and who I'm writing for, and then I gear my writing towards maybe something that we've experienced musically together or something that's, their sound is influencing or inspiring me to write something. But then there are other projects, like the latest one with, a host of people who we didn't have any chance to rehearse, and we just went into the studio and recorded. So I just had their sound in my mind, and it was a real combination of different players. So I was trying to find a way to find a middle ground so that everybody could grab onto something that they, that might resonate with them, but then also pull themselves into only being in the moment and improvising and, bridging certain gaps.
You, right around that time, I noticed that you played organ on an album of Black Sabbath covers, which I've never heard, but I'm really kind of fascinated by that. Are you a Sabbath fan? Like, what can you say about that record?
I am a Black Sabbath fan. I love Ozzy's book. I love Black Sabbath. That was Ivan's project, and I think he just wanted to go in the studio and record those tunes. So I don't know what happened to that album, or I guess you have it.
I mean, I just know it exists. I've never heard it, but it's very intriguing to me because, I mean, to me, Black Sabbath were actually like a much more swinging band than people give them credit for. Like, Bill Ward is a very swinging drummer. So
I think that was just a let's go into the studio and do this, it'll be fun situation. So I don't remember much about it. I remember sitting at the organ with Jeff. I think both of us were playing organ at the same time at one point, and I think we were messing around on all sorts of instruments and just having fun.
On your fourth record, you changed up all the personnel. It was Johnny Barrett on bass and Tom Rainey on drums. And so what sparked that change and also the move toward trio playing with no horns?
I guess I'd always wanted to try to play piano trio, some version of whatever that meant to me. And It was a little intimidating because it's such a common format, and there's so many great piano trios that have inspired me, and you know, that I've listened to and transcribed and all of that. So I was hesitant to go into the trio format for a while, but I don't know, I guess just after the quartet and feeling like maybe I wanted more space for the piano for myself in sonically to dive into that. So I've been playing a little bit with Tom and John, and I just thought they'd have a really good hookup, and then I wrote some tunes for that group, and then I think Ingrid snatched them away and she started Anti-House, and so Tom and John were in her group, along with Mary and I, and so it ended up being a good combination, like one of those classic. It was a good match, the pairing of those two, and I don't think they had done much playing before that time.
And right around that same time, the first Paradoxical Frog album came out. What was the genesis of that group?
Well, that was maybe the first situation I mentioned where we met just to play a session. I had met Tyshawn on another gig. I can't remember which gig it was. And then I met Ingrid through Tom Rainey, and she had just moved from the UK to New York. And, you know, I said, hey, you guys want to come over and we'll play in my living room. And so we met up, you know, really just to play a session. And I think we improvised for about an hour. And I think we all just felt like, wow, this is really something special. It was just this instant connection and sound between the three of us. And we were all, you know, prolific composers. So we brought in tunes, and we spent a lot of time rehearsing around that time, working on the music. And then we toured. That was my first tour to Europe, when we played in MERS, at the MERS Festival. And we did a couple other tours, a couple of European tours, and also in the States. And that was a really important group for me personally. I think I discovered just being comfortable with silence and space in that group. Tyshawn had this piece called Holmograph. And in that piece, there's, I don't know if you've heard that record, but we play just one note and then two notes for, you know, on the record, I think it's 12 minutes, but we'll have the note, and then there'll be these long silences, and then we'll hear the next note, and they vary in length and attack. But we would play that piece sometimes at concerts for 30, 45 minutes, and it was really, you know, it doesn't develop, that is the piece. And sticking with that and experiencing that with the audience and going through, it's like, it's really going through a process with the audience and just being comfortable with silence really made an impact on how I think about music now and when I'm improvising as well.
That's tough, because I mean, I feel like that might be the real challenge of any kind of music, but you know, creative improvised music in particular. I mean, I remember reading some rock musician saying that, you know, slow songs are the hardest songs in the world to play. Mm. You know, and I mean, you just stand there waiting for the next, you know, cue, and like your eyeball starts twitching, you know, like, come on, I need to do something.
Yeah, and your instinct, you know, after a while you want to change it, right? You want to create variety. You feel like it needs to change, and in that piece and a few of the pieces that we played, it's really built into the piece that you can't do that, and that made a lasting impression that composition could direct a certain amount of space and flow and pacing of a performance.
You seem to have a pretty strong creative partnership with Ingrid now. I mean, you're in Anti-House, you're both in Tom's band Obligato. Like, can you talk a little bit about the two of you or the three of you and how you sort of complement one another creatively?
Well, I think, I mean, first and foremost, we're just good friends. we like to spend time together and hang out. I think Ingrid's one of the most incredible composers and underrated composers, and her music is just a constant influence and inspiration for me. So every time we get together, you know, I learn something from her music and her ideas about how her pieces will come together. And, you know, now that we've been playing together for so long, it's like we can, you know, if I just write, like, it's just, that's Ingrid's sound right there. I don't even really have to think about, like, directing the written material towards her. I know that it's just kind of like, it's in my subconscious. We just recorded a duo record that's coming out next year on Intact. And, yeah, we both, you know, we kind of discussed, like, what kind of tunes we might both write for the project, and we came in and, you know, it was just like, yeah, this is, whether we have written music or not, whether we're, you know, playing a written material or improvising, both, we just have a sound together. And I think it stems back from that first moment when we played together as a trio with Tyshawn.
You've made two solo piano records, one in 2009 and then another one in 2012, and they're very different to me. How does it change your playing when you're the only person there? Like, do you particularly like playing solo, or do you prefer having other people to bounce off of or to inspire ideas in you and stuff like that? Like, what are the pluses and minuses of solo work?
I do like playing solo. I would say it's harder because you're always the one generating the material and the ideas. But I like that challenge, and I've been doing it quite a bit, I guess, in the last couple of years. And it helps also as just a practice to kind of keep that going and always confronting the idea of organizing your ideas and, again, like pacing and flow of certain things. I don't play too many, well, sometimes I'll play a standard or a composition, but a lot of the things I do are sort of just structural. They have, like, maybe a concept or idea that I'll be working with, and then, you know, my job is to flesh that out in the concert and be in the moment. And so it's improvisation, but it stems from certain cells and ideas. And then playing, oh, what was your other question?
Just, you know, how does it change your playing? Yeah, basically when, you know, when you're the only person. So you were saying, you know, you were talking about that, but I'm curious in particular about Massive Threads, because it's, the pieces on there, a lot of them are very different from other stuff that you've done. So talk about sort of the concept behind that record and what you were going for with those compositions and things.
I guess around that time I was using a lot of classical music, and I was doing this with other musicians as well, playing classical pieces in an improvisatory way. And I don't know, I just wanted to take some of those ideas, some of that music that I was learning, and transfer that into my solo piano playing. So the first piece on Massive Threads is that, I think it's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is the translation of Der Zauberlehrling, I think it's about right, the Ligeti piece, the 10th etude that he has. And it's not prepared, like I prepared the piano, and it kind of moves around sonically and harmonically into different areas, but the idea of this kind of gamelan effect with your fingers crossing over on the keyboard was the impetus for that idea and that piece. So I've always worked with prepared piano, so, you know, I'm always bringing in ideas from other places, other genres, and trying to see how I might be able to use that to inform my improvisation. And then there's another piece in there, I think the second piece, it's super slow, and there's this kind of clash between this melody that's super high on the piano and sticks out, and then this progression in the left hand, and that came from a Liszt composition that I was working on at the time. Mostly the progression, but I just, you know, this idea of like the right hand and the left hand fighting it out tonally and melodically and harmonically. Was sort of the idea there. So, and then I think I was using some Berio composition for another piece. So there was on that CD specifically, there was quite a bit of kind of contemporary classical influences in the performance.
Mm-hmm.
The Infrasound album, Save Your Breath, from 2015, was another one that I thought was really fascinating because of the kind of fixation on the low end that you got with the four bass clarinets and the organ and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of single instrument sections in there. It's not just like big drones, you know, or anything like that, but it still has like a real heaviness to it. So where did that idea come from, and how, you know, what was the process behind that one? I'm very intrigued by the arranging and stuff like that with that record. So,
well, I think at the time I was thinking about writing for a string quartet and then blending it with some variation of a rhythm section, and I don't know, just something hit me when I was writing and thinking like, oh, I don't know, maybe just feeling like this has been done a lot, you know, maybe I should try something different. What about some clarinets? What about four bass clarinets? And then also thinking about the rhythm section, and I don't know why, I think I was just, maybe I was trying to torture myself. Like, how can I make this the hardest thing possible, is dealing with three harmonic instruments with the organ and the piano and the guitar and drums, and like, how might this function together? And it really didn't end up being an issue because the organ ended up sonically fitting more with the bass clarinets, and that really became a group, almost like a quintet, and then the piano and guitar and drums sort of, you know, on the outskirts of that. So that was a cool discovery when I was writing for that project.
Mm-hmm. It also, there were also some pieces that you'd done with other groups that were rearranged for that group. So, and I know you've done orchestration and arrangement for some other ensembles as well. So what do you like about rearranging a piece for a larger ensemble, or about writing for 8 or 9 players generally? Like, what does that give you?
I've done quite a bit of arranging in the last couple of years. I think before I did that project, I was working on Novella, the Tony Malaby album, and I arranged 7 or 8 pieces for that ensemble, which was also, I think it was a 10-tet. But that was my first discovery into arranging someone else's music, and I don't know, I felt like the pressure was off a little bit to generate the ideas, or that the core idea was there, but then I could create all these other sonic worlds around the core material, and I don't know, it was freeing, and I could focus a little more on the arranging and the sonic of possibilities of the arranging, and I just didn't feel like it was all on me to generate, you know, everything in that, for that project. So so that's kind of stuck with me, and I'll, you know, I've continued to do that, where I'll take old pieces or someone else's composition and try to arrange it into a new framework, whether it's orchestrated for a new project or it's completely rethought of. Like, for example, the Master Threads album, there's a track of me playing Evidence, and I tried to think about it as if I was coming from, if I was Morton Feldman, how would I play this monk tune Evidence as Morton Feldman? So sometimes I'll try to, you know, change the context and see what comes out there.
And on the complete other side of the coin, I want to ask about the Duopoly record, because there's a lot I want to sort of ask about with that one. First of all, it's a CD and a DVD, so there's the videos of the performances with the kind of split screen effect. Do you enjoy being filmed while playing, or was that like nerve-wracking at all?
The camera on me was on a tripod, and because we were there for 3 days, I just kind of forgot about it. I didn't even notice it at all. Whoever the guest was, Mimi Shakarova, the filmmaker who did all the filming for that, she had a handheld camera and was walking around. And I mean, she's so careful and respectful of the artist that, you know, I don't think anybody really had an issue with it. But yeah, I try not to think about it. The filming doesn't really bother me that much. Yeah.
Do you, I mean, obviously, if you're used to, you know, being, there's a difference between performing in front of an audience and being observed while you're playing, I guess. You know, but that doesn't, like, throw you off your game at all?
Not when I'm playing, because I'm just in the music. I mean, it's a different, you know, when you actually, like, see it online or whatever, then, you know, that's your moment to scrutinize it. And, you know, that's, sometimes that's a little frustrating, especially when you're at a concert and, you know, you're playing the concert for the audience and someone's got their phone and they're videoing it, and it's not necessarily something that you want online. You know, it's pretty hard to navigate that and, you know, track people down and say, hey, I didn't want that on there on YouTube. But it's just the reality of, you know, where we're at in 2019.
So you're not going to, you know, go full Keith Jarrett on people and flip out and, you know, have people ejected from the jazz gallery or wherever?
I mean, like, John Zorn is really good about that. He, you know, he says up front, like, no, please don't film this. We're here for you. We're here for, you know, this is for you only. And I think that's really smart. I just forget to say that, I, you know, thinking about so many other things. But I've, you know, I'm trying to make a mental note to remember, you know, to ask people not to film it.
What I like is what King Crimson does when they play live. They make an announcement at the beginning. They say, please don't take any pictures or video or anything during the set. But at the very end of the set, Tony Levin, the bass player, is going to want to take a picture of the audience. So when he picks up his camera, you can pick up your camera and take a picture of us. You know, it's like a trade.
That's cool.
Yeah, no, it is. And if you go on his, like, Instagram account, I think there's all these pictures of, like, audiences from around the world wherever they play. So, you know, it is actually a thing that he does.
Okay. I guess you have to find a gimmick and go with that.
Yeah. So with Duopoly, the various duo partners, you had two guitarists, two drummers, two reeds, and two other pianists. So how did you choose the people? Did you get all your first choices, and did you, like, you know, prepare the material for those particular players and stuff like that?
Yeah, actually, I did get all my first choices, so that was a nice surprise. And especially, you know, I mean, people can say yes, but then when it comes down to the logistics of actually planning the date and time, that can, you know, deter certain things from happening. But yeah, everybody could make it. And I guess from the beginning, yeah, my producer and I, David Breskin, were speaking about sort of conceptually how we might present this project, and that idea of, you know, duopoly, like the duos, and then also kind of a duo within a duo, because there's the two guitarists and the two pianists, even though they're not playing with each other, there's sort of that thread of duos going on on different levels. So so that's kind of where that came from. And I did prepare the music. I think, I can't remember how many of my compositions, maybe there's five or six, and then I think Angelica brought her piece in. Then we played a standard with Don Byron, Prelude to a Kiss. And then in the spirit of duopoly, you know, duo playing and duality, we have the one composition that we play with each partner, and then also an improvisation with each one. So I think everybody was in the studio for about 2 or 3 hours, and we didn't rehearse before. We just showed up, and that was kind of the idea, was to just capture the first meeting of all of these people. I think everyone that was on the recording, I don't think we'd played in a duo format. I think Angie and I had played maybe once, a concert once as a duo, but yeah, so the idea was really to capture that initial meeting.
And what are the particular challenges of two piano music? Do you go out of your way to pick someone whose style is completely different from yours? Like, you know, how does that mental preparation go?
Well, I can only really speak to the projects that I've worked on, like with Craig and Angie, and both of those players they're super sensitive and intuitive players, and we share a lot of the same influences. So, and ideas about using written material and improvisation to generate ideas and improvise with. So with those two musicians in particular, and those are both of the pianists on Duopoly that I play duo with, they it was easy, you know, to play with them and fall into that. But there are times when I've played, you know, two pianos just in various circumstances. I think I did a thing at the Kennedy Center for a Christmas concert, and Cyrus Chestnut was there, and Harold Mayburn. And so, you know, we ended up playing duo, and I think at one point there were four of us on the piano while playing. And, you know, it's, I think it's just a shared language, and being able to navigate that and use that language to find a middle ground. So that's kind of how I look at it.
That was also the first release on your own label, Pyroclastic. Was that the plan all along to start a label, or was it that the labels that you had worked with a lot at that point, like Clean Feet and Intact, wouldn't do it the way you wanted or couldn't fit it into their schedule or something like that? Like, was it your choice, or was it, you know, did you feel compelled to get it out somehow?
Yeah. It was my choice to start the label. I think I just wanted to have a place where now I would release all of my music. It would be in one place, and I would own all of it and control, you know, that music for eternity. So that was really the impetus behind that. And now it's growing so that we have, you know, Ben Goldberg and Chris Lightcap and Corey Smythe and, you know, other artists that are releasing their albums on the label. And I turned it into a nonprofit last year, or a nonprofit that funds the label. And you know, so it's an interesting time for me running the label and also, you know, making music and teaching and all of that. And but yeah, it was really about just wanting to have my music in one place and have control over it.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're releasing records by other artists. I just interviewed Chris about his record. And
oh, great.
So what are your criteria for choosing which projects to support, and like how many records do you think you can feasibly put out in a given year and stuff like that? Like how is it sort of taking shape in your mind?
Well, next year we're trying to release at least four records, and I mean, the criteria is non-commercial music, ultimately, adventurous, creative artists, and also I'm interested in finding gender balance and diversity in groups, so that's an important component for me, and especially women leaders, but also men that are hiring women, because I think that that's something that's lacking in the jazz community still, and something that I want to support.
Mm-hmm. The second Pyroclastic release was the live duo album Octopus with you and Craig Taborn. So tell me a little bit about that tour and how it turned into the record.
I guess when we were recording Duopoly, our producer David Breskin, you know, heard us. That was the first time Craig and I had played together, and he was like, "You guys have to do this more. Like, you're just totally connected." And it felt like that in the studio. It was just that same feeling of playing with Tyshawn and Ingrid. Like, we just kind of had a connection, and it was easy, and, you know, the music could go in so many different places. So we wrote some music for a duo project, and then booked a two-week tour, and we took Ron St. Germain on the road with us. He's a great engineer that's been recording my last four albums, and David Breskin also came with us, and yeah, we recorded all those concerts, so we had all this material to choose from, and we kind of went back and forth on, are we going to release all of this? Do we want to release like a multiple CD set? But ultimately, I felt like, because we were playing the same compositions every night, I don't know, I just wanted to pick, the best of the best of those performances, and that's really what Octopus is, the album.
Yeah. You also, I noticed you played on a a Zodiac record that was a tribute to Cecil Taylor. Came out last year. What was your relationship to or with Cecil? Did you ever like meet him or talk with him or party with him or anything like that?
No, I wish. I've met him on the street a couple times. But I'm a little shy, so you know, I'm not gonna reach out and say, "Hey, hang out." Although I kind of wish I would have now, but yeah, at the time I wasn't really for that. So, but you know, I'm a huge fan of his music, and his music has inspired me to no end. So, you know, I was honored that John Zorn asked me to be a part of that and record something. And I was at the time really checking out that album Silent Tongues, and I think there's two versions of that first piece, and I was like, yeah, this is definitely a piece, not an improvisation or improvisation that he's playing, a composition that he's playing and using for his improvisation. So I tried to transcribe a little bit of that, and it just gave me some ideas to write a sort of tribute piece to him, which is the piece on that record. What is it called? Beneath the... It's a long title.
Yeah.
I always forget. Yeah. Trees on the Other Side of the Tracks.
Right.
I forgot the name of it.
Yeah, it's funny what you were saying about, you know, the long passages that are, you know, that seem improvised but are in fact not, you know, with him, because I remember seeing him play at Avery Fisher in the early 2000s, and I'll never forget this. He did like a half hour solo set and then a half hour trio set for the whole performance, and somewhere in the middle of the solo set, he just erupted in this like thunderous passage that, you know, hit every key on the keyboard like three times, you know, just this tidal wave of notes. And while we were all sort of sitting there recovering from that, he played the exact same thing again. So you knew that it was, you know, not an improvisation, it was a thing, and you were just like, oh my God. You know, it was just such an inhuman display of technique, you know.
I know, he had amazing technique and amazing touch and energy at the piano. I just, you know, that's all Cecil.
Yeah.
So my tribute to him is, you know, it's more of a conversation, mm-hmm. less of a trying to copy him.
yeah. So we talked about this a little bit in email, but you were part of Rob Masaryk's band for his Desert and Crypts Festival, the first one. So tell me a little bit more about that whole experience, like joining that band and the cultural environment that he's got going in Marfa and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I hadn't met Rob until that performance or that that trip down to Marfa, and Chad Taylor, who I play with often, recommended me for that gig, so... we went down for a week, and I mean, have you been to Marfa?
I have not, no.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's so beautiful there, and it's remote and mysterious, and then there's all these artists living in the desert. You know, this is like culture, like high art culture. It's very interesting. And Rob's into visual art, so he's dealing in that medium. But then, you know, he's also bringing the music, and the artists are very supportive of that. And so there's a nice theater there, and we rehearsed a couple of days and played. We all played a solo concert and then played a few nights in the theater. But you know, it's way out there. You fly into El Paso, and then it's a 3-hour drive to Marfa, and you drive through all these checkpoints. But you're still in the States, but you're driving through these checkpoints. So the driver was, you know, trying to say, like, you know, I hope you don't have any, like, illegal substances on you, because, like, we're going through this checkpoint and there's dogs coming, and, you know. So it was just kind of fascinating, like, wow, this is otherworldly. I've never quite experienced something like that. But, yeah, when I got to Marfa, Rob had these great tunes, and... I guess the thing I was most surprised about the music, I never played with Ingebrigts, and that group, especially Chad Ingebrigts, was something really special. And I think the trio as well. We have kind of a good energy and vibe between the three of us. So, and Rob's music has a lot to work with. So it's, you know, it's a fun group, and I'm happy to be a part of it. And I'd love to go back to Marfa. It's a really cool place.
It's a very interesting combination of players, because obviously you've played with Chad, but then Rob and Chad have a whole 30-some year thing going on, you know. And then Ingebrigt is just such a monster bassist, you know, because I know him mostly from working with Mats Gustafsson in The Thing, you know. Yeah. So he's like this huge, heavy, you know, player. So, I mean, like you were saying, that creates a completely unique sort of piano trio sound. Like, you really have to, I feel like you would really have to kind of battle for dominance in a sense, you know?
Not really. Everybody's really good listener, and I don't know, it has like there's this presence to it, and it's hard to explain because you just have to listen to the record. But Ingebrigt also, he played a solo concert in Marfa that just blew me away. I mean, I never heard bass playing like that before. It was freaking out. He's a total monster. It's a really fun project.
Yeah. And didn't you guys play some more recent shows to kind of celebrate the release of the album?
Yeah, we did two nights at the Green Mill in Chicago, and then we just played 2 weeks ago at the Chicago Jazz Festival.
And how did that go?
It was great. Really nice. I mean, we hadn't played since Marfa, when we played that show in the Green Mill. And, you know, I like that, you know, we didn't rehearse, so we were just trying to remember the material, and took a set to, like, remember what we were doing. But we got back on the horse, and then, you know, it just went from there. And I love the Green Mill. Like, it's three sets a night, and it just allows you to, like, really explore spaces. And, you know, it's that old school feeling of, you know, just playing so much that you get sick of yourself and you have to get over it and then try to generate new ideas. You know, we don't get to do that very often anymore. And I love playing at the Green Mill.
And now your newest record is Diatom Ribbons, which is really fascinating because each track has kind of different combinations from this large pool of players. And there's the electronic element, which is, you know, fairly new for your stuff as well. So, I mean, how did this record come together for you, like, first as a concept and then as execution in the studio and everything?
It kind of grew over time. Terry Lynn reached out, I think it was like 2016, and wanted to do some playing, and I was a huge fan of her. I listened to her growing up, and so I was really excited about that, and we went to Taipei and played with Linda Oh and Val Gentis, who's on the album. And and then shortly after, Jerry Allen passed away, and so we played, Terry was putting on a series of concerts in tribute to Jerry, and I knew Jerry's music. I had a few of her records, but I wouldn't say she was a major influence for me. So it was nice to really just get into her music and check out all her records and play her tunes. And so I was kind of living in her world for a moment there. And at that time, I was also playing, doing duo with Craig. I was, I played with JD for this Thelonious Monk Centennial at Duke Performances down in Durham. I was working with Mark Rebo, with John Zorn, and the Bagatelles project. And then, of course, Tony Malaby and Trevor Dunn and Jeff Smith are people that I work with all the time, and Tony has worked with for 20 years now. So I just felt like a lot of these players didn't know each other, and then also Esperanza is also on the record, who I met through Terry. But a lot of these players didn't know each other or hadn't played together before, and I just thought it would be really cool for them to come together and meet. And you know, I was so into the fact that Terry was so open to, like, we played a concert at the Stone, her and Val and I, and we played an improvised set, and she said after, "That's the first time I've ever done that." I'm like, wow, this is, like, for her to put herself in that position, taking a risk and you know, challenging herself in that way, like, really, you know, really influenced me. And inspired me to want to say, okay, like, great, you're open to this. Let's like bring these people together and just see what's possible. So I tried to write some music that, you know, brought everybody in and gave everybody a little bit to work with that they might feel comfortable with, and as I mentioned, and then also space for just free improvisation and things to develop. And I mean, the most interesting thing for me in the composition part of it was trying to figure out how to write for Val, and the tune Corn Creek, I think it's the third or fourth tune on there. I recorded, I think, 8 or 9 cells on the piano, and then gave those to her, and she broke them down into sections. And so then I would play them on the piano, and so when we're playing live, it's like having two pianos on stage. We have this kind of bouncing effect, where she'll play the material or play the piano, and it's like, you know, you don't know if it's DJ or piano or it's me. So that was really interesting, like just getting outside of writing the material in that way and thinking about how to incorporate what Val could do. And another thing was picking out these audio clips of voices that I wanted to have on the record, and one of them was Cecil Taylor. And
where'd you get that clip? Where did that come from?
So that's from the piano jazz with Marianne McPartland, his interview on that.
Oh, okay.
A little clip of that, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's clips of Messiaen talking about the bird calls, and that goes also with that piano piece I was mentioning. And then I had a few others that actually didn't make the record, but it was fun, like, going through and picking out clips and figuring out how they might work with the material. And, you know, and sometimes it got in the way and sometimes it enhanced it. And but it was more like in the moment kind of composition, where things were there and then we would, you know, take parts of what Val was doing in and out and manipulating it more sort of in the editing process.
And there's also the track with Esperanza singing. So, I mean, does this make you want to work with voices more going forward?
Totally, it really does. I've been wanting to work with singers. I mean, I've worked with singers a bit, but I haven't really written for singers. So that's something that's, you know, on my radar, and I'm hoping that to do, you know, in the future.
And I feel like this record would have sort of created a unique challenge in the sense, because you were talking about how none of these people had really played together before. So I feel like they would probably be looking more, even more, to you as the leader to sort of, since you were the unifying element, you know, to sort of like establish the ground on which everybody's going to be, you know, meeting. Was that your sense?
I don't know. Not necessarily. I think that because there were positions there, everybody could kind of rely on that, and I relied on that as well to create the platform and the space for connection. I didn't feel like pressured to have to like take charge. You know, I mean, I can do that if something's not going in the right direction, but I'm more of the kind of leader that I like to stand back and let things happen and be surprised by what I'm hearing and what people bring to my pieces.
I'm kind of curious about your thoughts about composition generally, I guess, because I feel like in the modern era, like let's say the last 20, 30 years, people are composing for their own groups. And I don't feel like there's much expectation that those compositions will enter some kind of larger catalog. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, nobody's, you know, like, once that record is made, once that project is complete, that's sort of the lifespan of that composition. Like, nobody's going to really pick it up and run with it in some other band to the degree, you know, that people played the standard repertoire, or even people play like Monk tunes, for example, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how that impacts the way you compose. Like, do you compose something that doesn't necessarily have to be universally rearrangeable in the way, you know, an older tune would be sort of infinitely malleable.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I have so many different ways of composing, and there's so much variety in the way that I approach composition. Like, even on this record, some of these tunes I think are, well, in fact, I have a chart, and I'm in the process of like creating a real book with Carrie Lynn for women composers, and one of my charts is going to be in there, and it was like, oh, okay, yeah, like, I don't know if I could say that all of my charts could really function in this format of having a lead sheet and like being in a real book. But yeah, if you, you know, at least the pieces on this record, there's a few that, you know, can kind of go in that direction. So it's an interesting thing, and I think we're kind of dealing with this right now as we're thinking about this real book. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, I think it's great that people are generating new material. Like, it's, and especially in our world of improvisation and composition, you know, it's how people learn to develop their own language and as improvisers and composers. But that being said, you know, like taking a standard and dissecting it and destroying it and all of that, you know, that's also something that I'm interested in, and finding pieces that I can do that with. And I mean, one of the pieces on the record, The Very Thing, is a composition by Michael Attias, which to me sounds like it could be a standard, you know, the one that Esperanza sings on. So, I don't know, I guess in that respect, I was trying to kind of reach out to some more modern composers and you know, close collaborators that are writing pieces that, you know, could be considered more, could be standards, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, people are still obviously writing in conventional and traditional forms. It's not, you know, it's not all sort of, you know, deconstruction and rebellion all the time, you know, because mm-hmm. that becomes just another language with its own rules and flaws. But
right.
But at the same, and I mean, I'm in a lot of my writing, I make an argument for new music because, you know, I, as a listener, I don't want to hear another version of All the Things You Are, you know? Like, thank you, I've heard enough, you know?
That's why I recorded that tune.
But it's, you know, it's just kind of like...
I can irritate you.
It's just, you know, there are a million standards and there are a million, you know, there are a million albums in what I call the young guy plays the music of dead guy genre, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, it is better to move forward, but I'm curious whether, you know, the cultural environment where you're just recording your own music with no thought that anyone but you will ever record it, you know, is even
yeah.
a factor in your mind, or maybe that's just something that non-musicians think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know, you know, once it goes out into the world, you never know what's going to happen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we recorded that Julia Temple tune, and, you know, I don't think that was meant to, or maybe he thought no one ever would ever record that again, but I had a chart of that tune, and, you know, it's so beautiful, and wanted to include it. So, yeah, I think it's just, once it's out in the world, you never know what can happen.
So, you have just joined the faculty at Berklee, which is an institution that's been undergoing a lot of change the last few years. I've talked to a few people about that. I talked to Tia Fuller for this podcast at one point, and I also talked to Melissa Aldana, who went there and who studied under Greg Osby while she was there. So
okay. What's
your mandate coming into the school, and what are you hoping to do there?
Well, the position is that I've taken on is Associate Director of Creative Development for Jazz and Gender Justice, and that's the institute that Terry Lynn started last year. So the institute is focusing on gender disparity and equality And that's the driving force behind the Institute and its mission. The my role in it is that I'm hoping to bring more improvisation, more free improvisation and composition in that sort of aesthetic to Berkeley. There are a few people that teach that, but it's not, my sense is that it's not a main focus. You know, there's not real, like a real community around that at Berkeley. So that's something I'm hoping to grow there as I continue my work. And I just started Monday, so I'm still figuring it all out. But, you know, the students, even this week I brought in some graphic scores and, you know, they hadn't heard of that before at all. So it was, you know, but it was great to just see them so excited about these new ideas and just freeing things up and, yeah, allowing for some different things in their musical world.
And how does this, how do you balance that and then maintaining an artistic career and then running the label and all that stuff? Are you sort of figuring that out as you go?
Yeah, figuring that out as I go, for sure. yeah, it's overwhelming, and I think because everything is just in the beginning stages, I'm still trying to figure out how to balance it all. And but I know, you know, once we get into a groove and rhythm with the teaching and the label, you know, they're going to be able. It'll get easier. It's just that this is a little bit of a grind at the moment.
You're still pushing the snowball. It hasn't started rolling on its own yet.
Exactly.
Okay, that was my conversation with Chris Davis, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. Subscribers are now getting exclusive articles 1 week before they appear on the main Burning Ambulance website. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.